Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week we're continuing the conversation with Greg Potter, PhD. But with a plot twist, we've had Greg on the podcast many times discussing all facets of sleep and circadian biology, but today the topic is low back pain. Greg has had personal experience with this problem since the age of 12 and has devoted extensive time and effort to researching and trying various treatment methods to find relief for himself and his coaching clients. He's quick to admit that he's not an expert in the area of low back pain, but it's clear that he's well-versed on the topic. On this podcast, Greg offers a thorough examination of low back pain, including causes, treatments, and scientifically validated approaches for relieving chronic discomfort. He discusses time-tested treatments, as well as cutting-edge options, including therapies, exercises, and supplements. He also recalls the book that started his healing journey and the best ways to give your back a break during daily movement and activities. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of untimely and irrelevant ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have our eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where our scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, attend live, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from acid reflux to C-reactive protein. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Greg Potter. Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you, Chris?
I'm excellent. Tell me about the conference that you attended in London. Was it recently? Was it any good?
It was last weekend, the Health Optimization Summit. It was good fun. It was the first event of its kind that I've been to since the start of 2020. So there was a lot of enthusiasm. People were happy to be back in the room. And it was an interesting mix of biohacker folks, a couple of scientists, lots of industry people too, and a few celebrities too, for good measure.
Nice. Anyone or anything you were particularly excited about?
Just catching up with people. I saw a few friends that I haven't seen for too long. And yeah, it was really good fun.
I saw that Sachin Panda and Diana Rogers were there. They've previously been on the podcast. Was there any content? Was there anything? Oh yeah, that's really interesting. I need to look into that some more. I'm just wondering if there's like the content of the talk tickled your fancy at all.
Yeah, unfortunately, I actually missed both of their talks. I was hell-bent on going to Sachin's and I ended up in a business related conversation for a couple of hours around then.
Okay.
So I didn't really glean anything from any of the talks, but I only went to two of them. So I wasn't necessarily expecting to. And that type of event, frankly, for me at least, is always more about the people that you meet and building relationships and finding out more about what's going on in certain areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely confirm that. The reason to go to one of these events is to shake hands and talk to people. Rather, you can always watch the talks later, usually, right?
Yeah, and it's very different to going to an academic conference too, because I think in that case, the knowledge that you gain is often helpful and sparks ideas about future research. The kind of presentation that Sachin Panda would give at the Health Optimization Summit is very different to one that he'd give at a chronobiology meeting.
Yeah, of course. Well, let's talk about low back pain. I was inspired to invite you onto the podcast to talk about low back pain because quite a long time ago now, I listened to you interview Stuart McGill on the Human OS podcast. And in that interview, I think you revealed that you had some previous experience with low back pain. And then I heard you again more recently, just the other week, in fact, on STEM Talk, where you alluded to the same. Can you start by telling us a little bit about your experience with low back pain?
Yes. And I'll also preface our conversation by saying that I'm not an expert in low back pain. I'm here because you asked me to be here. And hopefully, with that out of the way, I can still share some things that are helpful for people. But my experience is that I hurt my back for the first time when I was 12. And I've had back pain on and off since then. In terms of the back pathology, I remember having a scan when I was 14. I've got quite a scoliotic spine, so it's quite S-shaped if you look at it from the front. I've had various different symptoms over time, some sciatic pain, I've had a muscle tear, I've had chronic dull pain in my lower back too. And over time, it's generally got better. And I think that's in part because of the influence of Stuart McGill. I read his book, Low Back Disorders, in my late teens, which is very helpful. And I've also got some experience coaching people with different types of back pain. While I was at Loughborough doing my undergrad and my master's, I coached a group of sprinters. And one of those sprinters has ankylosing spondylitis, which is an autoimmune condition that tends to kick in quite early in life. So Harry at the time was 19 to 22. And that condition is a very stiff, arthritic spine. But I've also worked with people who have disc issues and some other forms of arthritis too. So I'm very interested in back pain. I've got personal experience of it. And I think one interesting thing to discuss is the different ways by which we can influence people's pain. So often somebody's focus is just biomechanical, or maybe somebody specializes in CBT or some other type of intervention. But when you can draw on a variety of different interventions, you can probably help somebody more than if you're just a specialist in any one of those areas alone.
Which is exactly why you're here, Greg. We like to take a holistic approach at MBT. And I think you're very, very good at that. Just remind us, how old are you now? So you're 12 when you first hurt your back.
I'm 32.
Okay. And what happened when you were 12? Was it a rugby injury or something else?
It was a rugby injury. And I don't know exactly what happened. Frankly, I didn't have particularly good treatment. And I think that was part of what set me on the course of becoming interested in health in general. And back then, I spent a lot of time on a Swiss ball doing all sorts of weird and wonderful exercises. And that also coincided with me becoming more interested in girls. So I started doing some other types of resistance training too, just things like push-ups. I remember having a stool in our living room and I would do literally hundreds of bicep curls with it. In retrospect, I realized those curls would have done absolutely nothing whatsoever for my biceps, but the good intentions were there.
I have to ask you this. We were talking about this over the weekend. Did getting bigger muscles help you attract girls? I guess there's no way for you to really know that, but what do you think?
That is an interesting question. Probably certain types of girls. And the types of girls that bigger muscles attract probably aren't necessarily the types of girls that might make good long-term partners.
Okay. I've always wondered if Playboy is for men and Playgirl is for gay men. And I feel like the same is true of going to the gym to attract sexual partners. Like, you're really, I don't think most women give a toss about that, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think there's an element of truth to that. I also have straight friends who are male bodybuilders. The majority of their followers, in a couple of instances, are gay men. So I'm sure that there is a kernel of truth there. With that said, I think also that if you take pride in your appearance, you're interested in building bigger muscles, losing body fat, and so on, then you probably are also more likely to gain a more attractive partner, assuming that you don't become a massive narcissist. And also, if that's something that you find very interesting, it could be that the person that gravitates to you shares some of those interests too, which might be a good thing for your relationship.
Oh, I would never try and argue against muscle. It's just that there's lots of reasons to build it, but perhaps that's not one of them.
I agree. I was a confused 12-year-old and now I'm a confused 32-year-old.
That's right. I'm still a confused 46-year-old, so I'm not sure the confusion lessens with age.
No, I think it actually increases.
Yeah, you just like know more of the things you don't know anything about, right?
Absolutely.
Tell us about how burdensome low back pain is worldwide. Is it just you playing rugby or is it a bigger problem than that?
Yeah, as too many people listening to this will know, it's not just me. And chronic back pain is the most common type of chronic pain. Chronic's defined as pain that continues for 12 weeks or longer, even after the initial injury or the cause of the back pain has been treated. And depending on the different review that you look at, the numbers vary, but a systematic review that I looked at of studies from over 50 different countries estimated that at any one time, about 12% of people have back pain. And over the course of a month, about 23% of people will experience it at some point. The prevalence changes, of course, with age. In kids, it's very low. So if you look at kids who are 7 to 10, it's likely that 6% or less of those individuals will have it. By the time you're into your teens, that number is closer to maybe 18% or so. And then if you look at people who are your age, Chris, probably looking at somewhere between about 28 and 42% of people. And obviously, it strongly affects your experience of the world each day, but it also has some other repercussions that will be relevant to some people listening. So some of those are economic. If you look at the US, then I believe that the total cost of lower back pain each year is thought to exceed $100 billion. And a lot of those come from indirect costs, such as presenteeism. So turning up for work, but not really doing any good work, in part because you're distracted by your constant pain.
Yeah, that's terrible. And part of my inspiration for inviting you on to talk about low back pain is, you know, my personal experience has been very good, but a couple of my very close friends have been completely removed from the sport that they love due to low back pain. One was kiteboarding. You know, we'll get into this. You know, did the image and found an abnormality, and then they did the surgery and maybe it got better, maybe it didn't. Actually, maybe it's worse in some ways. Well, let's do another image. Oh, now it's the hardware that we put in that's causing the problem. Let's take the hardware out. And of course, that doesn't work either. And the pain just goes on and on. And by the way, now you're on opioids, right? Or it's just like a, you know, cascade.
Vicious cycle.
Yeah, vicious cycle of unnecessary interventions. And then more recently, one of my older friends that I surf with has been taken out of the game by low back pain. And it does make you wonder, like, you know, what's going on here? Is this just a couple of people that I happen to know, or is it a much larger problem? And I think what you're telling me is it is a much, much larger problem.
Absolutely. And I've got close friends and family who have chronic back pain for very different reasons. But I doubt that there's anyone listening to this that doesn't know somebody who has chronic back pain that's at least quite debilitating.
Absolutely. So what is low back pain? And can you give some examples of what goes wrong with the lower back?
Yeah, lots of different things can go wrong with the lower back. And the lower back is basically the area between your bottom rib and the top of your pelvis. And the lumbar spine, this region, is where things tend to go wrong. So that includes lots of different tissues. You've got muscle, fascia, ligaments, tendons, different types of joints, neurons, vasculature, the bones themselves, the vertebrae, the discs between the vertebrae. And over time, those can all degenerate in certain ways. And the pain can come from any of those different tissues. And so people have tried to categorize this type of pain in different ways. A common categorization is to split it into mechanical pain and radicular pain, but they often coexist. And I think it's hard to make those distinctions. But with respect to mechanical pain, that's basically pain that arises from the spine itself, or from the discs, or from the surrounding soft tissues. And there are a few different examples of this. So one would be problems with the facet joints. And these are joints on the side of each of the vertebrae that basically limit the motion of each of those segments. And as the discs between the vertebrae degenerate and become smaller, they can become arthritic, these joints, and that can lead to some local pain. And it's typically the kind of pain that you can point to. It's quite focal, and it often worsens if somebody spends lots of time sitting or if they're engaging in certain activities, and it tends to reduce spine range of motion. So you sometimes see this with increasing age. This type of pain is myofascial pain. So that's pain of either the muscles or the fascia that surrounds them. And that can be due to overuse or to muscle tears or to spasms in the muscles. It's often caused by strenuous activities. And I mentioned I tore a back muscle while I was at school, and that was while doing high repetition snatch grip deadlifts, which is just a terrible idea, but I was an idiot. And again, this type of pain tends to lead to quite local symptoms. Another type of mechanical pain is sacroiliac joint pain. And these joints link the spine to the pelvis. And this can often be triggered by some sort of physical trauma. So, for example, strong rotational forces at the pelvis. And it tends to be quite localized to the buttocks, but it can also lead to lower back pain. And sometimes it radiates down the legs too. And then the other type of pain that I mentioned is radicular pain, which is sometimes called neuropathic pain. And that's the type of pain that radiates from your back down into your hip and often through into your legs. And sometimes it goes down below the knee too. And this can result from different things, but there's usually some sort of compression of the nerves through the spine. There can also be some chemical irritation as a result of increased production of various different inflammatory molecules that leak out of the discs of the spine. And unlike the type of focal pain you get from mechanical back pain, this type of pain often has what's known as a dermatomal distribution, meaning that it involves the area of the skin and the body that's supplied by the nerve root that's affected. And this is often associated with a disc herniation or with what's called stenosis. Both of those can impinge on the nerves, leading to this type of pain. In rare instances, it could be due to herpes or cancer, though. So I'm just adding that for completeness. And I mentioned stenosis then. Stenosis just means narrowing. People might have heard of aortic stenosis, for example. And that can occur in certain spaces within the spine, which then puts pressure on the nerves passing through the spaces. Sometimes that might take place in the spinal canal, and it's through that canal that the spinal cord passes. So that can affect the spinal canal, the spinal cord directly. There can also be thickening of the ligament that passes behind the vertebrae. It's called the ligamentum flavum. And then also, if you look at each of the individual spinal segments, then nerves come out of the side and they come out of the foramen. And these can narrow over time as somebody ages, and that can lead to some of this type of pain too. And stenosis as a broad category tends to be a direct consequence of age-related degeneration. So for example, excessive bone growth because of osteoarthritis. And it's therefore the most common cause of this type of pain in people aged 60 years or older. But with that said, a lot of the things that you do early in life can contribute to it. So if you look at research on twins, for instance, then it seems that people who play sports that involve lots of running and changing direction, so think football or soccer, get this type of pain later in life more frequently than people who spend lots of time cycling, which is good news for you, Chris. And this type of stenosis often associates with pain when walking. If you look at people who have this type of stenosis, my dad is one of them actually, they often have quite a wide gait and sometimes they have weakness in their lower limbs. Can also in some instances lead to vascular claudication, and that can result in symptoms such as quite cold feet. And these type of people often get some pain alleviation by flexing their spines. And unfortunately, over time, that can lead them to have quite a kyphotic posture. And that's the type of rounded back that characterizes a lot of old people. And then finally, there is the category of disc problems too. So the discs between your vertebrae have a few different functions, but they absorb shock and they allow spinal movements and they help distribute forces quite evenly too. And if you look at these discs, then a lot of them is made out of water. There's something like 70 to 80% of water. And they have two broad areas within them. So you have this nucleus pulposus inside them, which is primarily water. But then outside that, you have a casing named the annulus fibrosus. And herniation is when some portion of that nucleus basically pushes out through a crack in the annulus. And it can lead to all sorts of different symptoms, but those tend to take place if the herniation compresses a nerve. But there can also be symptoms during the healing process from that herniation, particularly if you get some new blood vessels forming and some new sensory nerves that end up penetrating the annulus and the nucleus, and that can lead to pain sensitization. And this type of disc-related problem is quite common in young adults, and herniation is the most common cause of pain before the age of 60. And they're often posterior disc bulges. So if you bend over with poor movement technique, you pick up something very heavy off the ground. So say you do a rounded back deadlift, then that bending forward creates lots of hydraulic pressure in the back of the disc, and that can lead to that type of herniation. But also, if you repeatedly flex your spine, so think of something like rowing, or if you do something in which the load isn't as high as a heavy deadlift, but the spine experiences high power, and power is just work over time. So it's force times distance over time. So you see high spine power and things like swing a golf club, then those different things can lead to herniation too. And this type of problem sometimes leads to quite local pain, but obviously because it can impinge on nerves, could lead to leg pain too. And one final thing that I'll add is that this type of pain might be something that varies over the course of the day. And you might also be more susceptible to this type of injury at different times of day, in particular in the morning. And the reason is that those discs between your vertebrae are hydrophilic. So they suck up water when you unload them, as when you lie down in bed, or as when you decompress your spine by hanging. And so during the daytime, the force of gravity and load bearing squeezes some of the fluid out. And that's why you shrink slightly during the daytime, then you grow slightly while you're asleep. But because you've got those pumped up discs, then like balloons that are now filled with water, the spine is more susceptible to that type of herniation. So I think it's especially important to avoid end ranges of spinal motion at the start of the day. So if you can only get to the gym before work in the morning, it's probably an instance in which you want to be extra careful about how you move.
Okay. And are there any sports that, say you had kids, that you would steer them away from? You mentioned some of the trouble you've had playing rugby, and you mentioned your dad too. Are there any sports that at this point are rather suspect for low back pain?
Well, there's certainly variation of types of low back pain that people might get from different sports. If you speak to somebody like Stu McGill, then he'll tend to point to some common offenders. So for example, I think martial arts is pretty rough on your spine, and there are some other ones too. He used the example of swimming, which I find interesting because the spine doesn't experience as high power as it does during some other types of sports. And the range of motion also aren't the largest, but it seems that that can be quite rough on some people's spines, which I think is counterintuitive to a lot of people. But obviously, like I mentioned, the type of sport that you do is going to affect your back in different ways. So if you row, then you're going to be disposed to some sort of posterior disc herniation. Whereas if you play something like hockey or football or any type of sport that involves lots of cutting, changing direction, then maybe over time that's going to lead you to have a more stenotic spine than you might otherwise have. And then you have the likes of something like CrossFit. And if you look at CrossFit and compare it to other sports that involve lots of heavy lifting, say powerlifting or Olympic lifting, the pattern of injuries that you're disposed to is different. And I think the issue with CrossFit is that people try to do quite complex, high power movements in the face of fatigue. And that's more likely to lead to technical breakdown during lifts such as Olympic lifts. And probably in part for that reason, you see higher rates of some musculoskeletal injuries in those people than, say, an Olympic lifter who is working incredibly carefully on technique, even with very heavy loads, and is rarely doing any sets of, say, clean variations or snatch variations or jerk variations for more than 5 reps or so.
And it seems to me, anecdotally, I've not looked at data on this, but cycling doesn't get a free pass. I've definitely experienced low back pain while cycling, and I've had really good results working with Nigel McHolland and then Abel Romero, and more recently Zach Couples, resolving that, and I've got that under really good control now. But it becomes especially important when I become fatigued, and it's like harder for me to hold my pelvis in place, especially whilst pedaling hard. I then tend to get low back pain. It also depends on the bike setup as well. A road bike would probably be worse than a mountain bike just because you're bent over more. But anything to add to that? I mean, it feels like cycling definitely doesn't get a free pass here.
Yeah, absolutely not. And I think the issue there is just prolonged flexion. And if your spine's already flexion intolerant, say that you've done some lifting in the gym and you've got a posterior disc bulge because you were doing Romanian deadlifts with poor form, or you've just done a very large volume of them over time, then that constantly flexed cycling posture might exacerbate that disc issue and lead to some problems. Another consideration is the type of cycling that you do, like you mentioned, because that's going to affect your posture on the bike. But also if, say, you're doing some off-road cycling and the impact forces are higher, your pattern of injury risk might be different from if you're a track cyclist or a road cyclist.
That makes sense. Over the years, I've been listening to Mike T. Nelson and Ben House, and also Zach Couples, all of whom have been on the podcast. And I've heard them talk about the discrepancy between the apparent health of somebody's spine as shown on an imaging study and what may be a source of their pain. Can you give some examples and talk about that?
Yeah, of course. And some people think that perhaps 9 out of 10 low back pain cases aren't associated with a well-defined cause. To be honest, I think that generally just reflects the lack of a good diagnosis. But some examples of that are in the case of stenosis. Not everyone that has that type of narrowing of the spinal canal through which the spinal cord passes will have radicular or neuropathic pain. And in one review, I think the range of spinal stenosis in people who didn't have any back pain ranged from very, very few people to about half of people studied. So it's quite common to see that type of stenosis, but with no symptoms whatsoever. In the case of disc pathology, again, a herniated nucleus doesn't always result in pain. And looking at another systematic review, the prevalence of people who had disc bulges but didn't have any symptoms ranged from about a third of people who are 20 years old to over 40% of people who are 80 years old. And by age 40 or so, a lot of people have disc pathology according to scans. So if you combine the people who have back pain and people who don't, more than half of people do. And related to what I just said, there's this whole category of pain that people nowadays tend to refer to as nociplastic pain. And it's what a lot of people historically refer to as non-specific pain, which again, I think is a bit of a rubbish term and it just reflects someone not really knowing what's going on. But this term is generally used for low back pain in which somebody hasn't identified a specific pain generator. And it's not that one doesn't exist necessarily. So I guess the question is, what explains that discrepancy between what you see on imaging and the experience of pain? Well, in a lot of cases, given that someone hasn't identified some sort of definitive cause of pain, a lot of people think that central nervous system processes maintain that pain. And in this category of pain, nociplastic pain, it's assumed that there's sensitization of the nervous system. And Chris, I'm sure you've come across the biopsychosocial model many times, but that's generally used to explain this discrepancy. And so some elements of this model are probably worth mentioning. One of those is that pain is distinct from what's referred to as nociception, which is basically the process by which different types of noxious stimuli are communicated through your nervous system. And with respect to pain, there are different types of pain. You have so-called fast pain that goes away quite quickly. And people often chalk that up to stimulation of a certain type of nerve fiber, so A-delta fibers. And then slower pain, which persists longer, that tends to come on from stimulation of C fibers, which aren't myelinated, explaining that type of longer experience. But pain isn't just due to these patterns of activity in these different fibers. And instead, it's clear that emotional processes, cognitions, behaviors also contribute to pain. And all of that partly explains that poor correlation between pathology and symptoms. And it also explains why some interventions that might have minimal effect on degenerative processes directly. So think about psychological therapies, can improve pain, and also why interventions that are intended to address pathology directly, so take the case of your friend who's had surgery, often don't provide benefit. And all of this, of course, relates to the fact that your brain is involved in pain. And there are lots of examples that we could point to, but psychologically traumatic events can lead to pain or they can reinforce it. Clearly, somebody's mindset will affect their experience of pain too. And in clinical studies, people who have negative expectations tend to have worse pain outcomes following, say, surgery. And all of this makes it quite difficult communicating with patients, because the last thing you want to do is say that your pain is all in your head. I think people with certain conditions, say fibromyalgia, have experienced this all too frequently. With that said, in extreme examples, I think pain all but is all in the head, by which I mean that it's down to somebody's neurobiology. And the extreme example that comes to mind is phantom limb syndrome, in which somebody has the sensation of having a limb that they don't have, or they could even experience pain in that limb. But obviously, there's nothing there. And that's because the brain is constructing the appearance of that limb and its pain too. So it's an extreme example, but I think it's relevant nonetheless.
Yeah, I feel like watching some of Lorimer Mosley's talks on YouTube were a life-changing experience when he presents pain as a prediction of damage, right? It's like it's what you said, it really is all in your head, right? It's that your brain is predicting that there's a problem. And it's not to say that there isn't local tissue damage or changes there. It's just that, like, that's what pain is. It's a prediction of something bad happening.
Yeah, so he's got his whole explain pain model, doesn't he? And I hadn't looked at this for years. I first came across his stuff in my teens, but I know that in recent years, people have started to look at their explain pain approach more systematically. And a lot of it makes complete sense to me. And I think, like you said, it comes down to how somebody interprets pain and teaching somebody about some of the different biological processes that are involved in pain generation and the fact that some of those are modifiable. So I think that the hypothesis of the mechanism through which their explained pain approach is working is that basically people can shift their expectations and their mindset such that they no longer have to protect themselves against some of these different things that have provoked pain historically. And so they can start behaving in more adaptive ways as a result.
Yeah, and I should give credit to our own Zach Moore, who was the first person to turn me onto this. You know, I had an incident where I did a cyclocross race that's like an hour of as high intensity as you can go. And then I was chopping some wood and then I did some heavy deadlifts. And guess what? My back exploded. And that's not a technical term that any physician gave to me, right? Like, it was bad. I couldn't get off the floor the next day.
And the perfect storm.
It's the perfect storm. And I had a call with Zach and he talked to me about the problem of catastrophizing about low back injury. And, you know, I was absolutely fine like 2 days later. Mm-hmm. And that made me think, well, how can there have been much, if any, tissue damage that healed in 2 days? You know, like if I'd crashed my bike in the race and skinned my knee, then that would have taken at least a couple of weeks to heal, right? Like, so what the heck changed in my back in that amount of time? And I think that does sort of confirm my bias towards Lorimer Mosley. It's like your brain is saying, can you just not do any more of that whilst I recover, you know?
Yeah, I think I fall somewhere in the middle because you have group of people, and I don't want to mischaracterize their opinions because there's a lot of nuance to all of this, and all of these people recognize that nuance in conversation. But just because I think people can misinterpret some of the things that they're saying, in the case of someone like Lorimer Mosley, they might misinterpret explain pain to mean that it's all in somebody's head and there's no association whatsoever between tissue damage and pain, when I think there definitely is. And I think one of the issues with imaging is that you can't really tell how recent some of that damage is. And Stu McGill made a really nice analogy. It's not even an analogy really, but he said that wounds create pain, whereas scars don't. The problem with imaging is that you can't tell what's a wound and what's a scar. If you're a very skilled practitioner, you might be able to, however. And it is also important to recognize that you need those periods of rest interspersed with those periods of loading, because some of these tissues can adapt relatively quickly. And related to those scans, you might see some presentations that to some eyes appear abnormal. However, some of those changes in the spine are in fact adaptive. So if somebody's been powerlifting for years and they have a very stiff spine, then it's that way to put up with the high loads of their training. Similarly, if you've got somebody who's been a yogi for a year and they've got quite a lithe and flexible spine, then they're going to have different types of spine pathology. But again, those adaptations to the exercise that in some ways enable them to do what they do.
That makes sense. So this whole thing, do you think it's all mismatch? You know, as you know, Greg, we've had very good results improving both my own health and performance and that of our clients by minimizing environmental mismatch, which you can think of as the difference between the modern environment and the one in which we evolved. And clearly that is different, right? Like I watch hunter-gatherers on TV on the National Geographic, and I don't see them sitting in chairs, and I don't see them playing rugby too much, right? And I don't see them powerlifting or riding a bike even, you know? So is it possible that the low back pain that we're experiencing is just all the result of environmental mismatch?
So I think this is such an interesting question. And the hypothesis that gets put forward is that some cases of low back pain, not necessarily all cases, are because the spine isn't well adapted to our modern conditions because they're evolutionarily very recent. And if you look at pre-industrial people, if that was possible, then presumably they were very active. And nowadays, our low levels of activity and the abnormal spinal loading that you were just referring to, whether it's playing rugby or chopping wood or whatever, result in weak muscles and unstable back tissues and increased risk of pain and injury. There's some support for this hypothesis. So for instance, if you just test somebody's back muscle endurance, it does tend to correlate with their low back pain, although frankly, it's difficult telling which direction the causality is. And then also some evolutionarily novel behaviors, prolonged sitting, for instance, in chairs and sleeping on soft mattresses, tend to associate with low back pain too. The problem, of course, is that we just don't have much data on this question. We know very little about low back pain in some parts of the world, and that includes pre-industrial people. And low back pain incidence is generally higher in high-income countries than in low to middle-income ones. In the US, it's particularly high, interestingly. And a few studies do suggest that some traditional cultures have low rates of low back pain. There have been studies of Aboriginal people in Australia, some rural people in Thailand, finding very low rates of low back pain. But one of the issues with these studies is that if researchers come in from the outside and ask these people about their pain, then it might not be that they report their pain accurately. And with all of that said, there's been some fascinating research looking at the remains of extinct species of early human populations. And there's clearly some lumbar spine damage in those different specimens. And this is true of Homo erectus, it's true of Homo heidelbergensis, it's true of ancient Chinese people, Egyptians, and also famously Ötzi the Iceman too. And you see lots of different types of pathology in these spine samples too. There's disc herniation, there's scoliosis, there's arthritis and more. And all those different types of pathology do associate with back pain. So I think it's fair to assume that these people would have had some back pain, although it's difficult telling the degree to which they would have done so. And related to what I was just saying, I think if you think about human evolution, then our disposition to back pain probably in part reflects our evolution from quadrupeds. And so some people think that low back pain is basically due to trade-offs in the spine because of the fact that we've become bipedal. Humans at some point stood upright. And so they took this spine, which has been evolved to be stiff for climbing, moving in trees, and they basically rotated it 90 degrees about the pelvis so that it's vertical. And this is, I think, aptly been likened to stacking 26 cups and saucers on top of each other, those being the vertebrae and the discs, and then balancing a head on top. And when you think about human anatomy, then one of the issues is that you don't want to obstruct the birth canal. And also you need the torso to be balanced above the feet. And what that means is that the spine had to curve inwards quite a lot in the lumbar region. So that's that lumbar lordosis with your bum pointing out a little bit at that particular region. So that combined with the weight of the upper body probably contributes to back problems as a result of increased shearing forces at the spine. And shear is just a force that acts at 90 degrees to compression. So to explain that, if you bend forward from the hips, so you maintain a neutral spine and you're just rotating forward at the hips, like you're in the bottom position of a Romanian deadlift, say, then in that position, your ribs are shearing forward on the spine. So that's what I mean by shear forces. And shear forces are more likely than compressive forces, which are just forces that go directly down through the spine. So if you're standing tall, upright, you've got lots of compressive forces as a result of gravity. Shear forces are more likely to cause pain. And so with all of that said, the back problems were presumably offset by the benefits of positioning your body's center of mass over the hips, which obviously stabilize the trunk and importantly reduce the energy costs of upright posture. And so basically, as a result of that evolutionary change, we're more energetically economical, so burn fewer calories to complete a given task on two legs, but maybe we're also disposed to pain. And then finally, I'll just mention that there's also been some comparative biology research looking at human spines alongside spines from other primates, which is quite interesting. There was a study in 2015 by Kimberly Plomp, who's a scientist based in Canada, And they took human vertebrae from the medieval period. They also took some chimp vertebrae, and chimps are knuckle-walking primates, and some orangutan ones, and they're climbing primates that use all of their 4 feet. And they found differences between the species in the shape of a vertebrae, which is no great surprise. And that obviously might be explained by the different ways by which they move and our evolution of being on 2 feet. Interestingly, though, when they looked at the human vertebrae, 54 of them had what are called Schmall's nodes. And those nodes indicate vertical disc herniation. And the vertebrae that had those nodes were more similar in shape to the chimp vertebrae than the vertebrae from the healthy humans. And while it could be that the shapes of those vertebrae have changed over the courses of people's lifespans, that suggests that the vertical disc herniation disproportionately affects people who have vertebrae that are more ancestral, in inverted commas, when you think about them relative to other humans. So it could be that some of our spines are more like other primates than other people's spines. And those of us who have more ancestral type spines are more disposed to certain injuries than others.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You've already mentioned that there can be a large discrepancy between what might show up on an imaging study and the generator of the pain. What are some of the other difficulties in assessing and then treating low back pain?
Yeah. So obviously good treatment depends on an accurate diagnosis. And that frankly is hard, requires different tests. Those tests need to be tailored to the individual because there are so many different reasons that people experience back pain. So broadly, I think people need to have their symptoms assessed. There need to be some tests of their physical function too. Imaging can be helpful in the hands of a good practitioner. It's not always necessary though. And if you speak to someone like Stu McGill, then he speaks about looking at people's motions, postures, and loads that trigger their pain and ease their pain respectively. And one of the issues that we face in typical healthcare systems, such as the NHS in England, is we don't have much time with practitioners, and often those people aren't experts in low back pain specifically. If, on the other hand, you went to see Stuart McGill, you get a 3-hour assessment, which is quite different from the 15 minutes that you might get with your doctor in England. And then with respect to treatment, that's notoriously challenging too. There's not much consensus between different practitioners on what's optimal. And I think some of the challenges here are that most cases of chronic low back pain are multifaceted. So someone might have pain as a result of some facet joint dysfunction, but they might also have some disc issues and they might have excessive muscle tension in some regions. Another issue is that there are really strong placebo effects with some of these treatments, and that makes it hard to come up with an appropriate controlled placebo condition in studies assessing the efficacy of these interventions. And then there's the fact that there's generally quite poor translation from different clinical trials of these interventions to practice. And my guess is there are huge differences between people in variables such as the competence of the practitioners of a given method. Chris, you've probably had good physios and rubbish physios. I certainly have. And then there's the fact that time is a great healer. And if you look at, say, disc herniations, the most herniated discs will have pretty much entirely regressed within a couple of years. So if you can entertain the patient and have them reduce the activities that cause them pain, then time alone is probably going to help them go in the right direction in the future.
And what sort of practitioners do you think people should consider? I mean, what's the deal in the UK with the NHS? I can tell you here in the US, you're probably going to have to see your primary care doctor first, which is a GP in the UK. Mm-hmm. And then the GP would refer you to a physical therapist. And I that is the right approach. It's the one that I would take for myself, say. But I think a lot of people, especially here in the US, they're tempted to go to a chiropractor. And, yeah. You know, I don't like to say anything derogatory about like entire groups of people. Like this seems like unwise. And I know there are some chiropractors that do really good work, but in general, it does seem to be questionable what they learn in school. Mm. And it seems to be, for the most part, a sort of magic trick that involves some cracking. And usually they have you sign up for a long series of appointments. And quite often they try and sell you some supplements along the way. You know, that's kind of the business model that and there's going to be some chiropractors that get mad, like saying, well, no, this is not how it is. That's certainly been my experience when talking to clients and then also friends and family. Yeah. What do you think about that? How does that differ in the UK?
I think a lot of the chiropractors would agree that what you just described is true of some of the chiropractors out there. Obviously, there are good ones and not so good ones. And that's true of any of these different types of practitioners, whether you're looking at a massage therapist or a chiropractor or a physio. Process that you go through as a patient in the UK, I think, is quite similar. So my experience has always been you go and see your doctor refers you to a physio, and the physio will then go through a certain number of sessions with you. And in my case, I know something about back pain. So it's a conversation with them, which is often quite constructive, and we can arrive at something together. But I can imagine that without the background knowledge, people leave quite confused about what to do. They might have had some brief descriptions of certain exercises. They don't have much support along the way. They don't have somebody to be accountable to, and so on. And again, the interventions tend to be, if not unimodal, then certainly limited in scope and not the type of holistic approach that you guys take at, say, MBT. So I think the experience is probably relatively similar in the UK to what it is in the US. And in terms of finding a good practitioner, unfortunately, I don't feel I have good advice, but there are some certifying bodies out there that train practitioners using methods that have been shown to be helpful for low back pain. The one that comes to mind, given my bias, is that Stu McGill does train practitioners. And so you could go to his website, BackFit Pro, and look at their system and find somebody who's certified in that particular method. But obviously that's discounting the fact that there are other methods out there that can be effective, that might be more effective for certain people. And so really, I think it ends up being a bit of a safari for the individual. And really, if you can find out something about the different methods that have been shown to help with back pain, and then look at people who are trained in those methods, and also get some insight into what people are saying about those individuals, their experiences with them, and so on, then you can be more confident in making a good choice of practitioner.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've had fantastic results with Zach Couples, and a number of our clients have. And that's not to say there aren't other physical therapists also doing excellent work. In fact, Abel Romero is one. He's been on the podcast. But that most of our bias is in that direction just because we've had such good results with him in the past, you know.
Perfect. Well, hopefully somebody listening to this goes to that person and experiences some relief as a result.
And then also, you know, what you said earlier about the PT having more time, I think that's true. Like when you're paying cash, like Zach is expensive, but, you know, as you mentioned, it takes time to get to the root cause and to take a holistic approach. And it's kind of not fair, like how much time, you know, say a physical therapist who's billing insurance get. I mean, maybe they get as long. I don't know. Maybe there's some models where they do, but I'm guessing it's going to be more leaning towards the, you know, super short appointments where it's very difficult for them to take a holistic approach and talk about some of the things that we're going to get into here in a minute, like sleep.
There are a couple of things to mention there, I think. So one is that there have been some programs that have been implemented to help people with their low back pain that have been costly upfront, but have ultimately saved people a huge amount of money. And then the second thing that I was going to mention is not coming to my mind right now, probably because I didn't get enough sleep last night. So forgive me for that. It will probably come back to me in just a second.
That's okay. I'm sure it will. And then you can just jump in and mention it when it does. Can you talk about some of the common low back pain treatments, starting with the movement-based ones?
Yeah, of course. And my perspective on this is that changing how people move should be at the core of all low back pain interventions. I think pretty much everything else is adjunctive. And just getting people to reduce their pain by moving better can be very empowering and can therefore quite strongly affect their psychology. And those changes in their psychology are the focal point of some interventions. So if you look at, say, cognitive behavioral therapy, then a component of that is the cognitive therapy. And I think in certain instances, that's not necessary just because these behavioral interventions can have such strong effects on people's experience. Now, with that said, the intervention needs to be tailored to the person, but there are some commonalities between programs for different people. And I'll mention a few of these, but they come down to using good so-called spine hygiene and not picking the scab of whatever the problem is. And so speaking about some of these principles, I think the goal should be to move well and move often, and certainly to start with moving well. And that entails a few different things. So one of them is maintaining a neutral spine when possible. And a neutral spine is basically the position that your spine is in if you're standing upright with good posture. So if you're picking something up off the ground, then you might squat by flexing your knee, flexing your hip, but you might still be able to maintain a relatively neutral spine during that process, as opposed to just flexing your spine while keeping your legs relatively straight. Given that type of pain sensitization that I mentioned earlier tends to come from chronic irritation of certain tissues, if you can identify and remove the different motions, postures, and loads that aggravate someone's spine, then that's bound to be good. So for instance, if somebody is flexion intolerant because they've got a posterior disc bulge, they shouldn't be slumping over to tie their shoelaces. And a better way of doing that would be to lift the foot to place on something maybe roughly knee height and maintain a relatively neutral spine in the process. I think, as I alluded to earlier, you certainly want to avoid taking your spine near end ranges of motion apart from outside of certain conditions. And that's definitely true of instances in which your muscles around your spine are producing lots of power. And you mentioned chopping wood earlier, Chris. That's certainly a high spine power activity. I think giving your spine a break when you can and when you feel you need it is really important. A lot of exercise addicts out there who have low back pain benefit from virtual surgery or sham surgery, in which they treat their back as if they just had surgery because it forces them to move very carefully and reduce their spine loading. Another way of giving your spine a break is just a practical tip, but if you're spending lots of time stood somewhere, then what you want to do is you want to stand upright, stand tall, and place your hands behind your back in the at-ease position. You can think of people in the military standing in that position. And just aim to keep your muscles relatively relaxed. That tends to quite strongly reduce muscular activity in many of the muscles around the spine because the vertebrae are stacked appropriately. If you spend lots of time sat at your desk, then you certainly want to break up those periods of sitting with brief periods of standing or movement. And you could do mobility exercises at this time to counter typical desk jockey posture. So obviously, if you're sat here, then your hips are in flexion, maybe your spine is a bit flexed too. So exercises to mobilize your hip flexors, there are lots of different lunge variations you can do for that. Exercises to mobilize your thoracic spine are helpful too. You also want to make your sitting environment ergonomically optimal for you, or at least as ergonomically optimal as possible. So if you're relatively young and you have a flexion intolerant spine, you'll probably benefit from some sort of lumbar support. And you might want that not just at your desk, but also in your car while you're driving. And if you do these different spine hygiene practices, then what you'll do is you'll build your capacity to do the activities that you really want to do. So maybe you love playing golf, or maybe you love surfing or whatever. All of these different changes are going to reduce your pain and make you more resilient against some of those activities too. Now, with all of that said, you also want to build your spine stability, and in particular, the strength endurance of some of the muscles around the spine. The analogy that's often used is that you can think of your spine as being a bit like the mast of a ship. And if you have strong and balanced guy wires around that mast, then those will help the mast stay upright and stable under high forces, windy conditions, and so on. In the case of the back, the spine is the mast and the muscles are the guy wires. And so you want to pick exercises that build the strength endurance of those wires while minimizing some of the forces through the mast, in particular shearing forces and rotational forces. So if you can use exercises that produce very high muscle activation, but minimal motion and shearing and rotational forces, then that's great. And Stu McGill advocates his big three, the bird dog, the side plank, and then the abdominal curl up too. And if you're not familiar with those, then I suggest that you just go to YouTube and have a look, ideally, of Stu himself explaining the exercises. And you can eventually progress those in lots of different ways. You can, for example, change some of the levers involved by moving your body. You can add load to them too. You can also use those for certain short-term effects. For some people, using them will acutely slightly reduce their pain, probably by increasing the stiffness of the spine. And that's why some strength athletes, for instance, use them in warm-ups before exercise, because in general, spine micro-movements can lead to different types of pain. And if you stiffen your spine by doing these exercises in the warm-up, you can reduce those micro-movements and thereby minimize any pain you might experience. And then after you've done these big three, you can move into some different exercises. So there are lots of different plank progressions out there. You can do front planks rotating into side planks. Sturie likes the stir the pot exercise, which is basically a front plank with your elbows on a Swiss ball and your elbows making a stirring motion in which they move clockwise or counterclockwise. And related to what I just said, I want to emphasize a point which I think is often misunderstood by people, particularly people who have a strength and conditioning bent. And that is that having high levels of spine muscle strength and power isn't always good. If you look at some manual jobs, then some of the people have stronger backs but lower strength endurance actually miss more work because of injury than people who have lower strength but better endurance. Presumably that's because the people who have better endurance can maintain appropriate lifting technique for longer. And the analogy that I like to use, which I think I probably mentioned to you on WhatsApp, Chris, is if you think of a car, then if you've got a really powerful engine, which in the case of the spine is really powerful muscles, but a frail chassis, the chassis being the spine, then those powerful muscles could quickly blow the chassis to smithereens. And so you don't necessarily want to add loads of strength and power fitness on top of a dysfunctional spine. And for that reason, starting with stability and endurance makes some sense. And then I'll just mention a few more things because I realize this is already a long answer, but hopefully some of this is helpful. One is learning how to brace your spine when lifting things can be transformative. And bracing the spine is like concurrently tightening those different guy wires to buttress your spine against load and prevent those micro movements that I mentioned earlier. And there are different types of bracing that you can use. One is a typical brace. And the way this is sometimes taught is if you take your fingers and you place them about 10 centimeters to the side of your belly button, you push your fingers in. If you brace your core to push them out, that's the same type of brace that you can use to help prevent your spine from buckling while lifting things. Another type of brace that you might want to try if that can lead to some pain is instead to focus on tensing your lats and your pec minor too. So the way that I used to coach this to people is if you're standing up, you can think of pulling your shoulder blades down into your bum pockets. And importantly, regardless of the type of brace that you use, you want to tune the intensity of that brace according to your needs. You don't want to create loads and loads of intra-abdominal pressure to pick up a pen from a table or a pen off the ground. You want to save that for picking up a sofa. Instead, you just want to match the brace to the requirements of whatever you're doing. Other things are, I think walking and carrying things can be great for your spine. When you walk, you want a walk tool, swing your arms. And over time, if you can walk pain-free and you want to build some fitness, you can progress to carrying different things. And if you're doing that in the gym, then maybe you'd start with some sort of bilateral carry. So that might, for instance, be using the trap bar to do some loaded carries. You could then do some sort of unilateral carry. So that might just be holding a dumbbell in one hand and walking a certain distance and then switching it to the other hand and walking back. You could then progress to a rack position, which is holding some sort of weighted implement. Maybe it's a kettlebell at about shoulder height, but with your upper arm tucked into your side. And then over time, you could also progress to holding something overhead. Again, maybe that's a kettlebell, maybe that's a dumbbell. And related to walking can cause some people back pain. You often see that in stenosis. And if somebody has stenosis, then something that they can do is basically interval walking. So let's say they have pain after 3 minutes of walking. What they might do is they might walk for a couple of minutes and then do what Stu McGill calls a park bench decompression, in which you basically take your body weight and you put most of it on the heels of your hands, resting those on a bench. And by doing so, you create some traction in the spine by unloading it. And then you just move your hips in towards the bench with your spine slightly extended and then hold that position for maybe 30 seconds or so. And that typically will ease any pain that's accumulated. And you can then repeat the cycle and build your capacity for walking over time. That's not going to fix your spine, but it might help you walk for longer periods while pain-free, while also preserving your spine in the long term. And then another key point is that while you want your spine to be stable and in some instances quite rigid, the joints around the spine, such as the hip joints and the shoulder joints, are very different types of joints. So they're ball and socket joints, and they're very mobile. And if you have adequate mobility and power at those joints, then you're going to help protect yourself against things like falls and other problems, particularly as you get older. Those can be very problematic. And the best way to mobilize those joints and strengthen them, of course, is through smart strength training. And it doesn't have to be anything remarkable, but if somebody enjoys that type of exercise, then I like seeing people working up to doing a range of different movement patterns if they can be done pain-free. So if you look at the hips, for instance, then I think including some sort of squatting exercise, which could be some sort of split squat, which is going to reduce the amount of load that you need on your back or by your sides. It might be some sort of relatively extended knee hip extension. I really like 45 degree back extensions, much more so than something like a good morning, because the forces through the spine are quite different, but you also get really strong activity in your hip extensors, so your glutes and your hamstrings too. I think some sort of flex knee hip extension, such as hip thrusts, is a helpful addition. The loading on the spine is pretty minimal. You get really strong glute activity. So if you want to improve the appearance of your posterior, so circling back to the start of our conversation, then those can be great. And then some sort of knee flexion exercise, I think, can be helpful, just because if you look at your hamstrings, then they don't all cross the hip joint. So the short head of the biceps femoris is just a knee flexor. So if you want to train that muscle, then including some sort of knee flexion can be helpful. Quite like sliding leg curls, which can be done off a rowing machine if you have access to one of those. And then I mentioned carrying things earlier. Some sort of loaded locomotion can be handy too. That could be sled drags too, which are great, really low impact, but a good way of targeting certain fitness capacities. And then the other thing that I just want to mention, this is one of the longest answers ever, I apologize, is good. You can be really smart about maintaining fitness qualities while minimizing demands on your spine. I never hear people speak about this, but say, for instance, that you value your cardiovascular fitness, but whatever your preferred mode of cardiovascular activity at the moment is off limits. And it just happens that other types of endurance exercise also aggravate your spine. Well, in that case, maybe you could use the sauna for some of the same cardiovascular adaptations. Take people, you put them through some sort of sauna exposure, you'll see increase in plasma volume. As a result of that, you'll see reductions in resting heart rate, increases in heart rate variability, you see some improvements in vascular function too. If somebody wants to maintain their musculoskeletal mass and function, then you could use some sort of low load, blood flow restricted resistance training to support your muscle mass while reducing joint moments. And to do that, you might only need something like 30 to 40% of your estimated one rep max in a given exercise. I know you spoke with Stephen Patterson about that, and I definitely suggest that people check out that episode for more. And then if you're an athlete and you compete in a sport that requires some sort of fine motor skills or impressive feats of coordination, so maybe you're a gymnast or a basketball player shooting free throws, whatever it might be, this sounds woo to some people, but there definitely is something to it. You can use visualization to help you maintain performance in certain movements. Even if you're a powerlifter and you're unable to squat pain-free at the moment, I think the practice of visualizing squatting with heavy weights is probably a good thing to do, and you'll probably find that you can actually retain your performance better that way than if you didn't go through that type of visualization whatsoever.
You're getting into Ellen Langer territory where you just need to think about doing the reps, not actually do them, right?
Yeah, definitely not saying that, but it can be a helpful intervention.
Or just think of yourself as someone who is a powerlifter and much stronger than the general population, and that will probably help too.
Yeah, that you just manifest it all, everything in your dreams.
There is a certain truth to this. Something you didn't mention there, and I found very helpful in the past, is, and I think I got this from Mike T. Nelson when I was working with him as a client, is like bracing with breath. So I'm about to pick up a barbell off the ground, then breathing in and like holding that, it feels, I don't know, like it's very confidence inspiring. It feels way more stable than not. Is that something you've thought about?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of a brace. Normally I should have mentioned it, but what you're referring to is the Valsalva maneuver. And you typically take
before,
you take a relatively deep breath and then brace. There are different ways that you can use breathing to increase the stiffness of your spine. So one practice that McGill uses, for instance, is you take a breath into about 70% of your capacity, and then you sip the remaining 30% before doing some sort of relatively maximal lift. So say, Chris, you were doing some deadlifts and you were doing a heavy single because you're a power lifter. I know that you're not a power lifter, but just bear with me. You might take that deep breath in and then the extra 30%, sip that at the end. So it'd be like, and then go into the movement itself. And if you do that, then you're going to help buttress your spine against some of those shearing forces that could predispose you to injury.
What about common non-surgical and non-pharmacological therapies that focus in part on the role of the brain in pain processing?
There are quite a few of these. So you've got you've got cognitive behavioral therapy, you've got mindfulness-based exercises, acceptance-based ones, and then pain reprocessing ones, which I find particularly interesting. And these different approaches have some commonalities. They're all trying to improve function by enhancing how well you cope with pain or accept it, and also encouraging you to engage in activities that you value, because people with back pain can become quite protective about how they move and some of the things they do. So in the case of CBT, what it's trying to do is help somebody understand and address the factors that can increase pain. And those can include things like muscle tension and psychological distress. And I won't go into these in any great detail, but they're broadly broken down into behavioral therapies, which tend to relate to exercise, so graded increases in exercise, and then also interventions to promote muscle relaxation at other times. And those might include things like progressive muscle relaxation or EMG biofeedback. And then the cognitive therapies aim to address certain thoughts that back pain patients often have. They might think, I'll never get better, or something like that. And those can lead to mental ill health, and potentially they could also contribute to pain. And so the goal of those cognitive therapies is just to help people recognize the thoughts and then look at whether they're objectively true and replace any negative thoughts with more positive and accurate ones. So recognizing there are still lots of things they can do. In terms of the effectiveness of CBT, it seems to be somewhat effective, and it can also improve recovery time after some sort of acute back pain episode. And it can help prevent the development of chronic pain if somebody has an acute pain episode. The results aren't stunning, but there's surely something to it. And one thing that I'll mention here is that I definitely think that it's worth thinking about combining some of these different interventions in smart ways, depending on the person. Then there's mindfulness, which I mentioned. The goal of that is primarily to just help people develop non-judgmental awareness and acceptance of the present moment. And mindfulness can lead to an impressive array of benefits, as I'm sure you've spoken about previously before, Chris. In terms of how well mindfulness therapies help people who have back pain, there was an interesting study in JAMA in 2016 that found that 8 weeks of group-based MBSRs, that's mindfulness-based stress reduction, led to quite similar improvements in function and pain to CBT. So these interventions might be somewhat comparable, though again, really depends on the quality of the practitioner and the individual. And then regarding low back pain specifically, if you look at all of the research done so far, then there's been a meta-analysis and they found that in general, the effects are quite small and they don't necessarily last. So we're not talking about large, durable effects. But with that said, I believe that if people dislike it or respond negatively to it, because there are people who do respond negatively to mindfulness training, then if that's the case, don't do it. But if that's not the case, then I would definitely give mindfulness-based stress reduction a go based on its overall effects. And that's especially true if the pain is comorbid with some sort of mental ill health, anxiety, depression, and so on. Again, going back to the idea of treating the whole person, I just think that that's definitely the way to go. And mindfulness might have some small positive effects on people's perceptions of pain too, especially in conjunction with those changes to movement that we discussed earlier. And you don't have to start with anything heroic. You can start with 5 minutes a day. There are some apps out there that have elements of mindfulness-based stress reduction. The mindfulness app is one of them, which I think is co-created by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is a great man and has contributed hugely to bringing mindfulness to the West. Then there's acceptance and commitment therapy. And Chris, I know you've spoken a bit about this before with Simon and co, and really like Russ Harris's resources on it. So I won't go into it too much here, but if you look at all the studies done on ACT so far, then it probably has a small or modest effect on physical function and can also help a little bit with anxiety and depression. In terms of pain and quality of life, the effects might not be quite so big. But again, there's so much variation between people and between practitioners. And then the other one that I mentioned is pain reprocessing therapy, which I think is fascinating. And it's only really come onto the map recently, so it's hard to tell how things will pan out. But this therapy basically emphasizes that your brain actively constructs pain, sometimes in the absence of tissue damage. And so if you teach people to think about the causes and threat of pain, then you can help reduce it. So that's congruent with a lot of the things that are espoused by other people. And the first test of this therapy for low back pain was published in JAMA Psychiatry this year. And the results were pretty remarkable. So they took people who had back pain for at least half of days over the last 6 months. And they basically split them into three groups. So one had the therapy, one had a placebo, and one had usual care. And the placebo was basically an injection, but the people were told and shown videos about the fact that even knowing that it's a placebo, receiving the placebo injection can in fact reduce pain. The usual care group just carried on what they otherwise would have been doing. And then the treatment group had 1 hour sessions with a therapist twice a week. And these different conditions lasted for 4 weeks in total. And the treatment group techniques included basically showing individual people evidence of the fact that they are experiencing some sort of centralized pain and helping them reappraise their pain sensations while going through postures that provoke pain for them. And then teaching people some different techniques to help them experience positive emotions and self-compassion. So there's a lot of overlap with other therapies, but they found that the therapy led to large reductions in the intensity of their back pain relative to both of the other groups. And nearly 2/3 of the patients who went through that therapy were pain-free or nearly pain-free at the end of the treatment. And interestingly, there were still large effects of the therapy after a 1 year follow-up.
Wow.
I know.
So wait, the intervention didn't continue. This is after withdrawal.
It's after withdrawal.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is impressive. And they also looked at some other related things too. So they looked at things like disability, anger, depression, sleep, and they found that those improved as well. So I think this therapy has a lot of potential, but whether people can make it scale outside of working with these very skilled practitioners, only time will tell. I suspect that will be a tall order.
Okay, so all that was just a very long preamble so that I can get you to talk about sleep, Greg. So how important is sleep for people who have back pain? And do you have any sleep advice for people who have back pain?
I'm not going to go off on a long ramble, actually. And instead, I'll say first, you've got to bear in mind the relative importance of these different things. And the changes to your patterns of movement, I think, are most important in most cases. With that said, low back pain often goes hand in hand with sleep issues. And this has probably been best demonstrated for insomnia. The prevalence of insomnia is higher in people who have low back pain than the general population. And insomnia is often comorbid with psychiatric disorders, depression, anxiety, and so on. Those themselves tend to associate with increased risk of progression to low back pain. Then there's the fact that there's some longitudinal research in which people have followed over time showing that insomnia seems to precede back pain. It seems that bouts of insomnia often come first before the back pain in terms of directionality, although I suspect it goes both ways because in some instances, spikes in pain can trigger insomnia. I think it's important to also understand that treating insomnia can help with pain. And there are some really interesting approaches to this nowadays. So historically, the focus has very much been on CBTI, but I'm particularly interested in the model which is being developed by Daniel Bicey and Alison Harvey, which they call TransC. It's this transdiagnostic sleep and circadian approach that draws on elements of CBTI and interpersonal rhythms therapy and chronotherapy and some other things too. But with that said, if you just look at the data on CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, it both consistently and durably improves sleep and reduces pain in people who have different types of chronic pain syndromes, including back pain. And if you want more information about CBTI, then definitely check out the podcast that you did, Chris, with Ashley Mason. It's terrific. Going to other sleep issues, short sleep does seem to be somewhat, albeit weakly, associated with increased risk of various types of musculoskeletal injury in people who play sports. So if you have a teenager who's playing team sport, then you might find that because they have to wake up at 5 a.m. to get going for school, but their body clock only lets them fall asleep at midnight, they're at higher risk of back pain as a result of getting insufficient sleep. So things you can do to support their sleep duration and time in bed are bound to help them. And then with respect to the bedroom itself, your mattress really matters. Obviously, get one with a money-back trial if you're getting a new one. In general, heavier people tend to need firmer mattresses. And if you and your partner are very different sizes, then you can get different sizes, different mattresses, different firmnesses for your different preferences. And then with respect to posture, this is intuitive, but you need to find a comfortable position for you. But you also need to consider the nature of your sleep while doing so. So for instance, if you sleep on your back, then that's going to magnify apneas and hypopneas if you have obstructive sleep apnea. And hypopneas are just shallow breathing where your oxygen saturation drops during your sleep. Pillows, the advice is much the same. Again, get pillows that help you maintain a neutral spine, and ideally pillows that also keep your head cool at night, which is going to help with your sleep quality. And then in terms of other support, if you're a side sleeper, which if I had to nudge people in a certain direction, it would be towards being a side sleeper. You might find that having a small pillow between your knees or some other type of support between your knees keeps your hips and your spine in a more comfortable position at night.
That's a game changer. You just nailed it right there. That was the source of my low back pain on one side, was that I would hitch one knee up really high, create stability in that side movement, and it feels really good. But you wake up in the morning, it feels the muscles of my on that quadrant on the side that you've hitched up did not feel good at all. And yeah, just a stupid wedgie pillow that my wife was given while she was pregnant. It's like, oh yeah, this is unbelievable. It's like a game changer.
Yeah, and you need to tinker. So use myself as an example. If I sleep on my left side and I have a pillow between my knees, that's really comfortable. If I sleep on my right side, even with a pillow between my knees, I get back pain eventually, which is quite interesting. If, however, I extend my right knee and I just have a pillow beneath my left knee, which is in a position such that my left hip is flexed, I don't have any pain when sleeping on that side. So you just need to tinker a little bit and find what works for you. Another thing I'll just mention is that if you sleep on your back and you have quite a lordotic lumbar spine, so you have quite a strongly extended lumbar spine such that your bum sticks out, then you might find that having something like a towel beneath your lower back while in bed helps ease your pain just by supporting your spine a bit and reducing some of the muscular activity that's necessary to keep it in that position.
And going back to side sleeping, what type of mattress do you like? I found that the firmer mattresses, and I think you alluded that they might be better earlier, they tend to be really hard on side sleepers, right? Like you're sort of that whole shoulder area goes to sleep. It's like not very comfortable.
Yeah, that is a common experience for sure. And again, I think the onus is just on getting a mattress that has a money back guarantee so that you can trial it for a period of time and find one that works for you. You might find that you need to go through a few. You've probably also learned over time, if you pay attention, whether you need a firmer mattress or a softer one. And for most people, just as an aside, I think hybrid mattresses or spring mattresses tend to make a lot of sense. The reason being that foam mattresses might not be quite so durable, and they also tend to store heat. And particularly if you live in a relatively hot climate, that might be a problem, because if you get too cold at night, you can always warm yourself up quite easily by putting on more clothes. sorry, if you get too cold at night, you can always warm yourself up easily by putting on more clothes. But if you get too hot at night, then it's not so straightforward to cool yourself down. So if you have a foam mattress and you end up overheating, a spring mattress or a hybrid mattress is probably a better option for you.
Okay. Yeah, you know where I've ended up? I'm still sleeping in the Eurovan, is an inflatable crap, like a really crap inflatable mattress. So it sounds super. So there's like a polyurethane foam that's just like the normal stock part of the VW Eurovan. And then I put the inflatable mattress on top of that. And it's like a $70 thing that you inflate with the bag that comes with it. And it just provides a cushion of air. So it's soft. So my shoulder sinks into it. So my shoulder doesn't go to sleep. But then it doesn't get hot like memory foam, right? Like, because the air, like, I don't know if you've ever slept on one of those huge air mattresses, you know, that are like 2 feet tall. They are so cold. Like, I defy anyone to sleep through the night on one of those without getting freezing, because there's no way you can warm that huge cushion of air. And so the thinner, cheaper air mattress is a kind of like that, but less so, you know, where you stay cool. Because I'm obviously in Northern California, and like it gets pretty hot here. And yeah, it's just kind of weird, you know, these spend thousands of dollars on a mattress or the $70 thing from Amazon, and the cheaper thing is better. But I guess that's maybe the takeaway, is you got to fiddle with this stuff and figure it out.
Yeah, and obviously there are also these mattress toppers, things like the Chili Pad and the Ula, that you can use to program
and that temperature changes too.
Yeah,
it doesn't work better than the air mattress, I swear.
Yeah, and also they're more energy hungry and so on. And then there's the whole new category of smart mattresses that are designed such that they have some sort of system of monitoring your sleep using some similar technology to what you'd find in something like a Fitbit or an Oura Ring. And then they change the in-bed conditions in response to what they're learning about your sleep to try and support your sleep. So maybe they tune the support that they provide your spine. Maybe they change the temperature of the top of the mattress too. And this type of technology is very interesting, and I completely see its potential, but they're very expensive at the moment and are therefore off limits for most people.
What about nutrition? How much does it matter? And are there any specific nutrition interventions you think are worth highlighting?
Yeah, it's difficult to tell how much it matters. And I don't think that anything that I'll say related to this will come as a great surprise. But the typical Western diet, needless to say, probably isn't great news for pain. And if your diet's based on processed foods, sugary foods, refined grains, seed oils, you don't eat many vegetables or much fruit. It's also therefore low in antioxidants, and you consume lots of lipids that can promote inflammation, a few lipids that help resolve it, then you're probably going to end up with high levels of pro-inflammatory mediators that then sensitize your nervous system to pain. So a better alternative is surely a diet that's based on whole foods. It's rich in micronutrients, polyphenols, certain fatty acids. So think those in fish oil, EPA, DHA, oleic acid from extra virgin olive oil, and protein. All of those are bound to help. In terms of the actual research, there have been some studies of different types of chronic pain that have looked at supplementation with certain food items. So fish oil and olive oil are among those, and micronutrients. In the case of back pain, there was a study that looked at intramuscular vitamin B12, finding some small effects. But the effects of those studies are generally pretty modest, and I don't find the data particularly convincing. But related to nutrition, obviously, is your body weight. And you would assume that weight loss is going to help with back pain because it's going to reduce spinal loads. And also, when people reduce their fat mass, they tend to reduce inflammatory processes too. A systematic review published quite recently didn't find big effects of weight loss interventions on back pain, but I still think that it's worth trying to shed any excess fat mass regardless. And to that end, there are obviously lots of simple things that you can try. We've spoken before about time-restricted eating. Your protein intake is really important, both for its effects on satiety and therefore total food intake, but also for its effects on retention of fat-free mass. And the main intervention point for increasing protein intake tends to be breakfast, because if you look at people in most developed countries, they consume a relatively low protein breakfast, a modest protein lunch, and a high protein dinner. So if you have a fist-sized portion of complete protein-rich foods at breakfast, think eggs, cheese, sardines, that type of thing, then that's great. And then also just generally opting for high fiber, low energy density foods, ideally with a high satiety index, can really help reduce food intake and therefore keep you lean or lose weight. And then in terms of supplementation, most studies that have looked at this are focused on knee pain and function as opposed to back pain, which is unfortunate. And whether supplements help you is going to relate in part to the type of pain that you experience. So if you have arthritic back pain, then my guess is that different collagen supplements and ginger might help. So in the case of collagen, a couple of those have been well studied. One is Undenatured type 2 collagen. There's a particular product, UC2, that's been quite well studied. It's thought to reduce joint pain and stiffness by increasing regulatory T cells that then produce anti-inflammatory cytokines. The dose is generally 40 milligrams. People often take it on an empty stomach just because of the fact that there's some competition for uptake of some of the things that are in it. And then there's also hydrolyzed collagen, which is typically taken with vitamin C. And that hydrolyzed collagen obviously provides amino acids for collagen synthesis. Some amino acids are particularly important, hydroxyproline, glycine, etc. And then the vitamin C is needed for enzymes that are involved in both collagen synthesis and the cross-linking of collagen fibrils too. And so if you take appropriate dose of those, you can help with things like how your tendons adapt to strength training. And there's some evidence, recent evidence, showing that that can help with some measures of athletic performance to rate of torque development, that type of thing. In terms of doses, it's typically 10 grams of hydrolyzed collagen plus 50 milligrams of vitamin C, although you could just have a piece of fruit, an orange or something. And it's generally taken an hour before exercise training and research, but it could probably be taken at pretty much any time of day. And then with respect to ginger, topical ginger, which is sometimes used, doesn't seem effective, but consuming it orally does seem to help with knee osteoarthritis. Whether it helps with back arthritis or stenosis, I'm not so sure. There was a review recently by some scientists who work for the military that looked at lots of different supplements for musculoskeletal pain. And they suggested that ginger was among the better ones, if not the best one. And it's not very clear how ginger acts, but it's probably in part that it reduces the synthesis of some inflammatory lipids, so some prostaglandins and leukotrienes, and it therefore modifies blood flow and the influx of some immune cells to the joints that are suffering from arthritis. In terms of dose, something like 3 grams of powdered ginger a day, probably divided into 2 or 3 doses, so you could just make ginger tea from that, is surely not going to hurt. Could help. It does have all sorts of other health benefits too, so I think that's a really easy win. And then in the case of other types of pain, if we look at radicular pain, which I mentioned earlier, that type of neuropathic pain, the supplement that I've seen the most data on recently is palmitoyl ethanolamide, PEA. And there's a particular type of that, Levagen, which is a micronized form that's assumed to be more bioavailable and appears to be more bioavailable, often taken 600 milligrams twice a day. And basically, this particular supplement is naturally, it's a substance that's naturally found in food such as eggs, and it's a lipid that seems to affect this type of pain by acting on some of the cannabinoid receptors and maybe influencing immune cells too. Related to its effects on the cannabis receptors or the cannabinoid receptors, it might also be a little bit anxiolytic and have some small effects on sleep. So if you're struggling a bit with anxiety in your sleep, then it might be a relatively good option for you to try. And there haven't been great studies of its effects on pain yet, but it does seem to help a little bit with some types of pain. There's been a meta-analysis of these studies finding that it does have some sort of small effects. And there have also been multiple studies looking at sciatic pain specifically, both using PEA in isolation and also using it as an adjunct to things like some drugs, an opioid specifically, and as an adjunct to massage therapy. So I think that's probably not a bad option to tinker with for some people. And then the other things I mentioned fall into that category of definitely not hurting, possibly being a good option. So generally eating things that support your musculoskeletal system is a good idea. And I mentioned protein, but also in that category is creatine monohydrate, of course. Dose is usually 5 grams a day, preferably with a meal. And then I think taking vitamin D3, particularly if your status is suboptimal, as it often is if you live at a high latitude during the short days of winter. And again, the research on low back pain isn't particularly compelling, but there's just not much of it just yet. And then the final one that I mentioned is glucosamine sulfate. And this has obviously been used for a long time to address arthritis. And it does seem that taking it might slightly slow the progression of knee arthritis. And it's thought that it has this effect by reducing collagen breakdown that results from too much inflammation. But it doesn't seem to affect chronic low back pain that much. The highest profile study on this was a study published in JAMA that looked at 6 months of 1.5 grams a day split into 3 doses, finding that it doesn't really do anything. And then there was a systematic review a year later looking at glucosamine and also chondroitin and MSM. And none of those seemed to do that much. But I still think that it's a good option for a lot of people to take, in that it might help with some instances of back pain. It's plausible based on the mechanisms through which it acts. And it also has some other benefits. So it seems to act as a precursor for the glycocalyx. And there have been a few studies in the last 3 years or so, probably a little bit further back than that, that aren't the strongest study designs, but they're really interesting in that they use massive data sets. So there was a study of the biobank data, for instance, that found that using glucosamine prospectively associated with less cardiovascular disease, so fewer cardiovascular events, and also less mortality due to those events. And then more recently, there was a study of the NHANES data that found similar results, but also that people who took glucosamine had lower all-cause mortality after adjusting for lots of different factors. So I think 500 milligrams of that 3 times a day is probably a good way to go. If not for your spine, then for your general health, and there's that small possibility that it could help with your back too.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think Malcolm Kendrick wrote about that in his new book as well, I'm pretty sure.
I haven't read that book, but I know how much you love him as a guest. So I love a contrarian. And
guests don't get any better than Malcolm, that's for sure.
He's great, isn't he?
Yeah, the book's called The Clot Thickens, and I'd obviously highly recommend my interview with him. Was there anything else that we didn't get to today?
Well, another quite long conversation, so I hope that people aren't bored to tears and that there were a few nuggets in there. But I just say, think about what's most important to you, and that might mean making some compromises. If you want to be a high performer in a given sport, then your back will be affected, and maybe that's worth it to you. And also, if you're going to be a high performer in a given sport, then you probably won't be able to have certain capacities that you could otherwise develop. Powerlifters aren't going to be great yogis. And then if your goal is longevity, then think about developing different physical capacities, so strength and power and speed and endurance and mobility and balance, to levels that are going to buffer you against frailty and therefore potentially loss of physical independence later in life. But doing so while sparing your musculoskeletal system. You don't have to sling heavy weights with bad form to develop those, or you don't have to run with poor form to develop those. And we spoke a bit earlier about the fact that actually there are ways by which you can get many of those adaptations while sparing your joints along the way. So things like blood flow restricted resistance training, but also simple modifications to exercises. So say you love squatting and you're using the squat to build your quadriceps and your adductors primarily. You could use pause squats instead of regular squats and thereby reduce the load that's on your spine, but while still stimulating your muscles similarly. And there are all sorts of instances in which you can use things like pauses to reduce joint loading and thereby potentially prolong your ability to do those exercises that you love and benefit you later in life.
Well, this has been really, really helpful. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate you. I know that you're working with people one-on-one to a certain extent. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And I think we spoke briefly about this at the end of the previous podcast, and we recorded that not very long ago. I don't actually know if that's out yet, Chris. But yeah, I am doing a bit of work one-on-one with people and with some companies too, So if anyone's got any questions or wants to reach out, then they can do so via my website, which is gregpotterphd.com.
Okay. And what, if anything, in all the above that we've talked about, can you help people with? Obviously the sleep part.
Yeah. So I can't help with the diagnosis part or anything like that. But when I help people, I try and help people relatively comprehensively. And so while in rare instances, maybe the focus is just on, say, cognitive behavioral therapy interventions for insomnia, usually I'm also helping people with their exercise and their nutrition and different self-regulation practices, so things like mindfulness meditation, and thereby hopefully providing better results than they would otherwise get were they to focus on a narrow set of interventions. But the final thing that I'll just say is that I realize this type of podcast can be overwhelming, that there are lots of different points at which you could intervene and you don't need to do lots of them. I know, Chris, you've spoken with Simon about, say, his SEEDS journal and using that type of approach in which you pick a few relatively easy to enact behaviors to start with. And in the case of something like spine health, maybe that's focusing on some of the basics of spine hygiene first, but then building additional interventions into your practice over time such that after a few months, you're doing things very differently, but none of the steps to getting to that point seem particularly strenuous or taxing.
Yeah, absolutely. Divide and conquer. That's what I would do if I was listening to this podcast and I had low back pain and I was naive to most of the things that you've talked about. I'd probably start with a Kanban board, honestly. And you can do that on a whiteboard with sticky notes, or you can do it in Trello or some other software thing. And then just create a sticky note for all of the things that you talked about. And Elaine produces fantastic show notes, so that'll be really helpful for creating those sticky notes. And you can just put the, you know, a few things in your to-do column. Okay, this next 2 week period, what can I do in the amount of time I have available? And divide and conquer, you'll get there.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Tell people where they can find you online, Greg.
Yeah, gregpotterphd.com and at gregpotterphd on social media.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you.
Pleasure. Thank you, Chris.